My name is Joe Barnt. I'm from New York City. And the Bible study this morning is going to be on Exodus. So if you have Bibles, we're going to look at Exodus and the theme of liberation. As all of you, I'm sure, are aware that Tuesdays during this Rainbow and Mountaintop experience is a special day in which the primary context for almost everything that's done on Tuesdays, as well as many, many places on the rest of the day, is on the rainbow experience, and especially the Afro-American experience. One of the most important aspects, as many of you, I'm sure, are already aware of the Afro-American experience and the experience of people in the third world, throughout the world, as well as in the United States, seeing the Bible from a new point of view or from one of the oldest points of view, depending upon your perspective, as a source book in the understanding of the nature of liberation. Not just simply liberation from a spiritual, isolated spirit from the body and from the body politic, but rather understanding the Bible as teaching us about the whole of human experience, including informing us deeply and profoundly on what the struggle for peace and justice is about in this world and not just the next. Liberation theology was in a sense born in the last several decades, but as anyone who comes out of the Afro-American experience has already said to you many, many times, I hope, that it's born out of the centuries and millennium experience of what it means to be a free person and to be struggling for freedom out of oppression. I'd like to especially speak this morning, and as a matter of fact, I want to just use an introductory study of Exodus in order to get to a single question. It seems to me that, and I want to, if we have time in the end, conclude about this, at least if not then, it'll be part of our discussions in the next days to come, is that one of the questions that we who are, even in the midst of this rainbow experience, Holden's population predominantly white, need to be asking something about our own identity in the context of a rainbow. The color white, if you've studied rainbows, is also not excluded from rainbows. But that is not just simply a question of course it is, but it's also a question of how and to what extent and in what way does people who come out of our European-American experience, predominantly white, predominantly of a class that is seen from the underside as the oppressor class of people, understand ourselves in the context of the Christian faith in terms of our identity, our identification, and our role in struggles for liberation, and what does liberation mean to us? I have a specific question I want to ask about that in the context of the Exodus story, but in order to do that, I want to spend 20 minutes or so looking at the Exodus story, and then I want to ask the question, and then hopefully have time for at least some time for discussion and a beginning response. But it's also a question I'd like to hopefully have laid on us for the rest of the day or as long as you'd like to think about it. And I'll come to the question after we go do some introductory work with the book, with the story of Exodus itself. While people of color and people who are advocates of liberation theology have been attempting to lay on our consciousness again and again and again that the book of Exodus, the story of Exodus, and the entire biblical experience from the Exodus through the resurrection is one which informs the total body politic, body and body politic, spirit and body, there are still strong, strong advocates in the church, in the traditional church, who say this is not to be done. And that the, for example, the Exodus experience can only be seen in theological, spiritual terms and does not apply to and allow itself to be seen in the context of any kind of political reflection. And that's a struggle that still goes on. The Division for Mission in North America of the Lutheran Church in America, about a year or a year and a half ago, put out a study of the sanctuary movement, for example. And I need to say this frankly and openly, if we're going to struggle about this frankly and openly, and which they basically, and I'm extrapolating a little bit, I don't have it to quote specifically in front of me, point out that any use of the study of Exodus for informing a political analysis of what it means to be struggling in the sanctuary movement is illegitimate, because the Exodus can only be used for spiritual theological purposes.
Egyptians would love that.
Anyone who heard Marilyn read the background for the spirituals last night heard, however, something different. Heard her read a portion that said that for the slaves, Christianity became the basic refuge of understanding what freedom was about. The spirituals, let's go down Moses, way down in Egypt's land, tell my people, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go, were not just simply a spiritual understanding of Exodus, but an understanding that while the masters had used the faith, had used our Christian faith to teach obedience to slaves, they did not recognize in the process their own stupidity and the high intellect of the slaves who couldn't, and thinking they would not pick up a Bible and learn about liberation and to read the book of Exodus and know that God meant them to be free. And from that, learn the songs, make up the songs and sing the songs, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. I'd like to have you and me struggle for a few moments both about the use of the Bible and teaching us more, not just about our spirit's liberation, not just the old, as the oppressor community always teaches the oppressed community, God promises you pie in the sky when you die, by and by, but rather whether or not the biblical experience and the biblical witness teaches us something about what it means to be struggling for peace and justice in this world, even though we know it will be fully coming to us in the next. And then secondly, I'd like to have us use this time to struggle with the question of what that liberation message means to people who come out of that which is seen by the majority people of the world, out of the oppressor community. What that means for you and me, who are seen by the majority people of the world as coming out of the oppressor community. What liberation struggles and what the liberation experience means for us and for our people. In doing so, let me quickly run through some of the outline of the Exodus story as it's seen by people who look at it, whether it's slaves of 400 years ago in the United States or people still enslaved to economic or racial oppression in our own day-to-day, who pick up the book of Exodus and see it as a universal story. A story that is not just happening then, but happens today over and over again. Now Joseph, this is chapter 1, verse 6, and all his brothers and sisters and all that generation died. Remember, they'd been there for, according to the 14th chapter, 430 years. And Afro-Americans in the United States see that number also as one which immediately says, how much more could it be comparable to our experience, even in terms of counting days and of waiting for freedom? Now Joseph and all his brothers and sisters and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. And once you hear, as people of color, as people who are oppressed, read this story and hear what they've been hearing all their lives in this generation, said in these many, many thousand years ago, as the oppressor community looks at the oppressed community with great fear and sees a foe more than anything else, the fear of numbers. And it wasn't in our generation that white people in the welfare offices started saying, when they pointed to the people who were oppressed and say, "My God, they multiply like rabbits." But it started thousands and thousands of years ago of the fear of numbers. A new king who did not know Joseph came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become too numerous for us. They've been multiplying like rabbits." Oh no, it doesn't say that, but it says almost. "Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them. And if you heard Steve DeGrucci talking last night in the panel discussion, and hearing in the discussion that followed as we were discussing that, that behind all racial oppression must be seen an economic analysis. Behind all oppressed people, racial or not, one must see the motivation is that the privileged people may have laborers, may have people who are going to provide the comfort and the money and the basis for economic privilege. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built for them Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. And if we had time to go all the way to the 14th chapter, Pharaoh's last cry as he climbed on his horse and ran towards the Red Sea the last time, trying to cut them off, change his mind again, and his last cry as he called his soldiers to follow him, he says, "Come, we've got to stop him. We will lose their service. We will lose the economic benefits that will happen," as he ran to the crashing waters of the Red Sea and was willing to die rather than to lose the economic privilege of slaves. But the more they were oppressed, and here comes again the numbers and the fear of population explosion, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. And so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. Now there's a couple of myths here. And you're gonna hear even later, if we have time to get to it, when Pharaoh passed the straw laws, to take the straw out of the bricks and make them work twice as hard to produce so many bricks. The basic mythology that's behind this is that if you make them work harder, not only will we benefit economically better, but they won't have time to make babies. And the constant result in that previous verse that I read is repeated again and again in the Exodus story. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. And the more they multiplied, the more Egyptians feared their number, and the more they oppressed them. And you know, that's a mythology that still continues today, whether you're studying population explosion in India or Guatemala or the South Bronx. There's two divisions of what the scientific people believe about that. And one is that if you cut off the population explosion by some means, the economic basis of the world will change and those poor people will get over their poverty. Or at least that's the theory. Maybe the real truth is the getting rid of the numbers that we fear. But the theory that is expounded is that economic improvement will take place when you cut off the population explosion. And that whole mythology creates this: the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. And so the more they multiplied, the more they oppressed them to try and stop the multiplication. If we keep them busy, they won't have time to make babies. But the exact opposite results. And there's an entirely different school of understanding population expansion and explosion that says what happens is that when the oppression is taken away, it's the exact opposite result. It is the population explosion is controlled when oppression is taken away. And that when people become entirely developed, a whole new understanding, a whole new secure base of economically and security, a whole different view of what it means to be having many, many children. We can go back into study in that, but it's a mythology about that that goes all the way back into the oldest of oppressions. And then just one more story about the comparison that's seen by oppressed people when they read the Exodus story, and then I'm going to quickly go through the rest of the story and then get to the question I wanted to ask you. The comparison, the other one, is in this next one about the story of the midwives, Shephra and Puah. most of you probably already are aware that that oppressed people already know deeply, powerfully inside of them that survival means their understanding their oppressors better than the oppressors understand themselves. White racist or oppressors all over the world like to think that the people they're oppressing are very stupid and that they know them better than they know themselves. In fact, the opposite is true. The survival of oppressed people is dependent upon oppressed people knowing their oppressors far better even than their oppressors know themselves, and the ability to trick them for their own survival. In the black community, they call it shuckin' and jivin'. This is a story of shuckin' and jivin' many thousands of years ago. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live." Still trying for the population control, sort of an ultimate method. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do, and they let the boys live. And then Pharaoh, king of Egypt, summons the midwives and asks them, totally outraged, "What have you done? Why have you let the boys live? Disobeyed my orders." And then here comes the shuckin' and jivin'. Midwives answered Pharaoh, "Well, you see, Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives can arrive." And Pharaoh said, I didn't know that. And God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. And then Pharaoh gave the ultimate order: of every boy that is born, you must throw into the river, but let the girls live. Well, the story goes on, and it's a lengthy story. When it's read by people who are struggling for liberation, when it's seen from the context of a liberation struggle, it becomes a very modern story that's been repeated and is being repeated around us every day, whether in the United States or in the Philippines or in Korea or in South Africa or in Nicaragua. A young baby is born who is destined to be the leader of a liberation struggle. His name is Moses. A friend of mine calls him Martin Luther Moses. And his classic story of his life as he's rescued just before he's thrown into the ocean, rescued by one of the oppressors, the daughter of Pharaoh. He's adopted, and he's raised as an Egyptian. He's raised, if it's seen from the context of today's story, he's raised white, with a privileged white consciousness. And he's raised with power. And he's taught a new identity, an identity that denies that he is an Israelite. And he's taught to reject that identity and to use his privilege to tower above that identity. And he's used, as is so often used in our society and in every oppressive society, as a demonstration: see, we treat them good. We got one here at the top, just like, and we treat them good. But Moses, by the power of God's Spirit, goes through an experience that is what women's liberation calls the click experience, of something clicks, or something explodes, or whatever the proper terminology is to use it. Moses, you remember, went, and we don't have time to read it in the full details. I hope you'll have the chance to reread the whole Exodus story. Moses happens to come across an overseer beating an Israelite. And all that's been taught, all that's been brainwashed, all that's been driven into him about his identity and his privilege flows away in an instant. And he sees a brother being beaten, goes out of his mind, and in fact kills the man who was beating the Israelite, has to go into exile. How many people in today's liberation struggles who lead the liberation struggles have to spend much of their time before the moment of the actual ultimate end of the struggle coming to place, have to go into exile and spend many years in exile until they can go back and join the struggle. At the burning bush is called back, and called back to be the leader of the liberation movement of the Israelite people. All of these marks of the contemporary story are there. The internal struggle amongst the Israelites, some of the Israelites not wanting Moses to come in and bust up a good thing because they got a hustle going. The Pharaoh using the straw laws to try and turn the people against Moses. They say, I remember Richard Daley used to always blame the communists and the outside infiltrators on the civil rights movement in Chicago, you know, and say I really hate to put these harsher laws into effect, you know, but it's the outside agitators that made me do it. Pharaoh does the same thing. I hate to put this straw law in effect, but if Moses hadn't come in here and messed up your life, you know, I wouldn't have to do this because things were nice until he came. The whole internal struggle of Moses drawing and building the unified movement of the liberation struggle together. The demonstrations, the plagues, the 10 major plagues. 10, is that right?
Yeah.
10? The 10 major plagues. Demonstrations, the demands. Pharaoh and his duplicity, constantly giving and then snatching back, giving and then snatching back. How many times have that been true in our own country and in so many countries throughout the world in the struggles? It gets serious, and it becomes a time when the final demonstration is the taking away of the life of the firstborn of Pharaoh. There may be some comparison in that, in the news that we received yesterday or the day before, that the South African Council of Churches has reached that terrifying decision of endorsing armed resistance, and making almost certain in that terrible struggle in South Africa the inevitable confrontation and blood that will flow. The final end comes and the liberation of the people. Pharaoh says, okay, you can go. And then, as I mentioned at the very end, even as they're getting ready to cross the Red Sea, Pharaoh changes his mind one more time. We cannot stand the economic effects of losing our slaves. And he hops on his horse and takes his army to charge down to try and cut them off at the pass one more time, screaming at the top of his lungs, we cannot lose their economic servitude. And then the Red Sea takes place and the freedom takes place. That's the story in its broad outlines. You remember most of it.
Drowning in technology.
Pardon?
The image of their high-tech chariots being
drowned
downfall.
in their own technology, right. I'm trying to decide whether I should stop for a moment and have you reflect a little bit on that story or just get into the question. Does anybody have something about that story that's just that they just want to throw into it before we get into the question I wanted to ask? Go ahead.
I'm always struck by the opening part of the Pharaoh's shrewdness in all of this. And right, we must deal shrewdly and therefore we oppress them.
Yes.
And that, of course, is the author's joke. This is what shrewdness is about.
Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of humor in that. There really is. And the humor is very difficult to see from the top side, but from the underside, the butt of all the jokes is the Pharaoh who assumes his intelligence and assumes the total ignorance of those who are being oppressed.
An often ignored parallel to the story is in the case of Israel, the oppressor nation of the Arab, the Palestinians. And the plot is very precisely in terms of the Arab population increasing. They are the source of, they're a slave population, virtually. And the Israelis don't know what to do about it.
There are many ironies in the contemporary living out of oppressors' histories.
The part I hadn't remembered before, but it came to me, was Joseph's land policy, before he died, and taking away the land from the farmers and consolidating Pharaoh's power, really, in Egypt. And then the irony of then having his descendants be the oppressed players. sort of raises a question about, can people be in power and not be oppressors?
Let me get to the question. Let me remind you, in asking the question, what I've asked that we struggle with this morning is two basic things. And one is that out of the European American traditional Lutheran biblical interpretation, the application of this text to an understanding of liberation through liberation theology, of what it means to be struggling for peace and justice, for the kingdom of justice in this world and the next, and not just the next, is not considered to be by many, or perhaps even by most, of traditional European Lutheran background, a legitimate thing to do. But from the long experience of oppressed people and the contemporary several decades old development of liberation theology, it's a major confrontation of that today for us to hear from the underside, as the Bible itself was written by people from the underside, an understanding of the application of the Bible that doesn't come through to us very often when we're just spiritualizing it. That's the first thing. And to be struggling in your own mind, whether this is new or old to you, where you are with this. The second thing is, in the context of liberation struggles that are happening and liberation theology as it's understood, is the question of, as you and I are seen, if you're listening to me with the ears of a person who comes out of European, American, white, middle class or upper middle class identity, you and I are seen by the vast majority of the people of the world who are on the underside as identified with the oppressors. And what I'm asking is to struggle with the question whether what that means to you and what we do with that identity, and especially what does liberation mean to us? What does it mean for us to be liberated? It's a kind of a simulation game that some of us have been doing for some years with the Exodus story, while doing a racism analysis and teaching of racism analysis with people, and for other purposes of teaching the book of Exodus, to ask people, after doing through a brief study of the Exodus story as we've just done now, to go through a small exercise. We don't have time to do that today because it takes a good hour just to do this exercise. So I want to tell you about it, but I want you to think about it also, how you would be doing this. And that is to ask people to break up into small groups of one, two, or three, and to spend a few moments with a question, and then come back with an answer to that question and present it to the group. And the question is, if you take your identity, as you identify yourself today, if I were to ask you to stand up and introduce yourself, your name, your age, your residence, your profession, your family situation, the basic things about yourself. If you were to take that identity, as you would give to us if I asked you to do that right now, but instead took that identity and wrote it into the Exodus story. If you projected it back into the Exodus story and gave yourself an identity in that story, not a new, not a fantasized identity, but an application of your actual identity today, what would it be? And how would it be to fantasize that, to build a whole story, to tell the story, and to go away and do that for 10 or 15 minutes and then come back and we'll go around and everybody stand up and give yourself and introduce yourself. Your name is, and your age and your family situation, where you live and what's your profession, and how do you live out your life. It's a fun thing to do because people just love to get into that kind of a fantasy that also takes their own identification seriously. You doing that in your own mind right now? A little bit?
Yeah.
Who would you be? What would you be?
Ramesses von Herzfeld.
Go tell that Pharaoh. people come back in my experience of having done this maybe hundreds of times with wonderful, wonderful fantasies about themselves back in that story with creating wonderful universities and or tremendous experiences around themselves and their identity and their families or the church, the pastors, or whatever your identity is, take it back there and put it back there. The reason for asking the question, though, is a little bit of a trick. Because what I'm interested in when people do that is, after all the introductions are done, to ask, to have kept count, and to find out how many people have given themselves Egyptian identity, and how many people have given themselves Israelite identity. You know, all of the other stuff for me in terms of this game is just a fun part to get to that question. Whether or not you would have given yourself an Egyptian identity or an Israelite identity. I come with my own set of prejudices about this and my own convictions about this, and that is that I believe that if you were, if you're white, you're an Egyptian in this story. Or as Vivian Jenkins Nelson used to do when we used to do anti-racism training together, she used to just look at somebody who just would, who would call themselves Israelite. She says, "You do not look black to me." And it's interesting, and the tallies that I've kept kind of informally over the years is that the more theological training that people have, the more they insist on calling themselves Israelites. Now, there's some reason for that that's understandable within the context of our authentically calling ourselves spiritual cousins of the Israelites as Christians. There's some good reason for that. That you and I must, if we see ourselves as baptized children of God, first of all, see ourselves as Israelites. The Old Testament is our book. We are Israelites who celebrate the coming of the Messiah. And so in terms of our spiritual history and who we are, there is a legitimacy to calling ourselves Israelites. But in terms of understanding the Bible and its message to us about liberation, there's another whole kind of a twist that must be given to the story. And it's the question whether we insist on always only spiritualizing the Bible, or whether it is authentically a record, not just the Exodus, but down through the entire biblical history of people's struggles to bring and celebrate the kingdom of God in this world and not just in the next. My belief, my conviction is that if we are white in this story, we must see ourselves as Egyptians.
Once we've seen ourselves as Egyptians, we also have to see ourselves as Israelites, because we too are oppressed. But I think we have to assume an Egyptian identity first, because I was fantasizing. I said, "Well, clearly, I'm going to end up priestess of Isis." And then it occurred to me, the famous idea, what's going on with Isis worship. But what I do is subversive, so I identify with midwives.
It seems to me that part of the tragedy for us Anglos, that's the term we use in the Hispanic, whatever is in Hispanic is Anglo. The tragedy for us, in my own experience, is no matter how much you really try to identify with the oppressed people and work for them, there's still a residue of belonging to the oppressor class. As North Americans,
we still think and still, to some degree, treat the people from that viewpoint. And it's all kind of instinctive. It's, you don't realize you're doing it, but they do. And that's, that for me is a constant call to repentance.
Pablo Piero that says that only the oppressed can free themselves. And if we don't understand how we as white Americans are oppressed by the system that causes us to benefit from oppressing those who aren't white Americans, then we never can escape. And only the oppressed can free themselves.
But do we want to really free ourselves, we North Americans, from our oppression?
Not as long as we don't see any oppression.
See, the whole idea of the American way of life is that we are the best, we have the best nation, we have the best standard of living, we have the best everything, and there's no nation that can compare to us.
Right.
And we really don't want to give it up. We really don't want to risk it.
And we really don't
want to lose all of our conveniences. And so we're not ready yet to fight against our own oppressors.
I'm granting that. I'm saying that until you see yourself as oppressed by all of that, you aren't going to do anything about it.
Even when you see yourself, you don't always do something about it because that has such a hold on you. There has to come that click moment. And I don't think for our country that time has come yet. There's a time coming when it will come.
I have a couple of additional things I want to add to my understanding of what this means, but I'm going to just open this up some more for discussion before I do, just to let some more reactions just come out about, at this point, just reflecting on that for yourselves, where that comes for you. Did you have your hand up?
I was saying a comment on, I read a couple of articles out of the Atlantic Monthly a few months ago on, in a sense, the black exodus from Chicago. In other words, where the people who are in a sense, the oppressed group, move out of the centers where I think that you have the greatest level of poverty and oppression and lack of education, lack of all kinds of things. And that as they move out of that, the tendency is not to return. And I'm wondering what reaction you get sometimes from the black or minority who move out of the situation. Do they get different attitudes? Do they have the attitude of the Egyptian?
Within the context of the Bible study for this morning, I'm going to just ask to hold that question for a while because I'm really going to ask to start off with about how white people respond to the image of being Egyptians, rather than asking how black people then or now will respond to their identity, but rather to what's your initial response to the assertion that projecting your identity back into that story. You understand the story and your role in the story as an Egyptian.
The image that comes to me is sort of looking out a window in Egypt and watching the people get ready and sensing a great excitement and also sensing that I don't belong to that excitement and never could, but sort of wanting to get on the wagon too and maybe, but also being maybe high up in the window and looking down on this activity. That's sort of the feeling I get from it.
I recall a book written by Stringfellow called My People is the Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the lawyer who lives in Harlem with people trying to be them. He represents them in court all kinds of cases and realized most of it is just tokenism. And he never, even though he lives there and tries to live there with me and get the feeling of it, he said, I can never be there because I always have a way to get out. They don't. They're stuck. He said, I'm a lawyer. I can leave at night and nobody helps. He just felt you couldn't enter and be one of them, much as he tried. And I think he lived most of his life trying to be with the oppressor and know how it is. I don't know if he's come beyond that.
Yeah, he died a year and a half ago. He's really free.
He died on Block Island, though. He became a judge and finally had to leave Harlem for good. It was killing him.
Did he go down with the Berrigan brothers? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dan Berrigan lived with him on Block Island.
But do you feel that that's one way we're trying to know? You know, you want to know how that feels when you're not born? It takes you a long time to be sensitive. Mm-hmm. I'm one of these places, and we are who we are, but you want it to be different than that. How do we arrive at that point?
More reactions. What's it? We spend a lot of time. One of the things that does come to us and in many, many ways is our need to try and understand what it's like to be Black or Hispanic or Native American and to try and understand that. But this is a reversing of that question. Do we understand what it means and how it feels to be white? And what does it? Or do you agree with this? If you disagree with it, please feel free. I'm not trying to make you want to be, in your own sense of who you are, an Egyptian in the story. I'm asking how you react to that. What does it mean to you to talk about yourself as an Egyptian in the story? Joey?
You know, one of the problems, it seems to me, when I think about the Exodus story, or any sort of story about liberation, is that all of the people in it, on both the Egyptian and Israeli side of things, are actors in the story. I mean, they are self-consciously part of the history that's unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And what you don't have in there are the masses of spectators, the mm-hmm. masses of people who don't have the slightest idea that they're involved in history. And it seems to me that one of the major problems, at least in European background America, is the sort of detachment from history, mm-hmm. the absolute curtain wall between most people's experienced lives and their individual and interpersonal realities, and the fact that those interpersonal realities are a part of a larger picture. I mean, what's absent in that story for me is what is the lives of ordinary people who mm-hmm. are Egyptians.
Yes. Which is what I'm asking us to fantasize.
Yeah.
What's it like to go back in this mm-hmm. story and be an ordinary person in this story with an identity that fits into that which is unfolding and which is true to what your identity is today, over here and then here.
I guess that for me, just the kind of understanding that I have of political processes and culture and socialization is that there must have been a group of Egyptians that were appalled by the treatment of the Israelites. And whether they were powerful or whether they were, how they made that known, my guess is that there were righteous people who were Egyptian. Just like within the power structures in South Africa, you have the Steve DeGrucci. You have in our culture people who stand up and speak out. And I guess that to me that it's a struggle to know whether in my own fantasy whether I would be there or whether I am here now. I don't know.
Yes.
But I think that there was. We don't hear that. We don't hear and I guess that's a part of the story that I miss, especially as you presented it and kind of opened up a new door to it. Apparently, you'd like to see where that counter movement, the counter culture within the, to get a pattern, if nothing else, to try and go on.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really the purpose of doing that, and tying very much in with what Jody said, is that doing that also asks the question of where we see our participation. In the same struggle today, when that comes back out. Ingrid?
I'm real, the thing that hits me repeatedly about this is how nifty all the women were. They're the sensible ones, they're the ones that, when they, and they weren't rich and famous, but they were sort of, you know, being clever and making the best of it and struggling for the lives of their children and real. I mean, there were lots of women in here. There's seven daughters and there's sisters and mothers and children. And
other than Moses, and Aaron, they're the major actors. Yes.
Yeah. And to me, that just sort of obliterates. I mean, I don't understand Egyptians and Israelites very well anyhow, so the main thing to me is the women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it's my theme.
The one that was rich and famous, of course, was Pharaoh's daughter.
Yeah.
Moses' mother.
Mm-hmm. Moses' surrogate mother.
Stepmama.
She must have been really shook when Moses went back to his people.
Or maybe she was one of the righteous Egyptians that he's referring to. I mean, obviously she knew when she opened the basket, she knew it was a Hebrew kid.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe she helped sneak him out of the country when he got in trouble. Huh? That's right. It's possible. One of the interesting reapplications of that, of our reality to that, and then bringing it back out again for me, Ingrid, has been, and we had a brief discussion on that in the staff Bible study this morning too, is seeing and feeling the struggle in the women's movement today between white women and women of color,
mm-hmm.
and of the mistrust in the approaching each other, and of the building of new trusting relations and the alliances, and what precisely that means, to put the image back into the story of Egyptian and Hebrew women coming together for liberation in that story.
You go a little further into the story, though, and you'll find what Joe points out to the exacerbated problem in another direction. Moses had a sister, you know, named Miriam. Yeah, extremely uptight because of who chose Moses for a wife. Racial conflict there. I suppose one could say that Miriam had a right to be uptight about Moses marrying a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, the color of the women back in Egypt were, you know, considerably darker than those of Israel. But, you know, that's some interesting dynamics that went on there. And of course, then this male god stepped in and resolved that question.
I've been struggling with it ever since.
Yes.
What male god?
Well, I'm struggling with somewhat of a cultural identity, I guess, as a third or fourth generation Scandinavian. I've lived in Chicago, I've lived in Alaska, where Native American and black people, and then the women's movement too has hit me. And sitting around doing little crafty things during Bible study, I'm not sure that's part of my heritage. So the whole question of, you know, am I an Israelite? I don't understand that culture. I don't have a culture anymore. I'm not an American. I refuse to identify with McDonald's arches or whatever, you know, so I'm feeling real detached. Jody hit this a little bit. I don't know where I'm planted. So it's real hard to identify myself in that story in Exodus, let alone in my own culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I need to ask a question. What time do we stop?
We'll stop at 10.
At 10 itself, or not 10 up, okay. All right, I'm gonna go in for about 5 more minutes for the discussion. I do wanna have a couple of closing things with some responses to it.
One of the things I learned working with Native American people has to do with stories. And they tell the same stories over and over again. And these are specifically what they call teaching stories. And it's influenced how I perceive the Bible now. It reflects a little bit on their sense of cultural identity, perhaps. I think something out of perhaps the Enlightenment and maybe before took away our stories. We don't have those stories as stories, except our stories are recorded in this book. you listen to the story, and the story is always the same, but you have always grown, and you are always different. Each time you hear the story, it has the capacity to impact you in a different way. And so, at one time you'll hear the story, and you should figure out how to put yourself into it. The stories are always familiar. The only thing that changes is you. So the stories are always new.
I have kind of a
got first, then back there.
Concrete kind of picture. When I think about myself as an oppressor, it's more like somebody standing on a chair, you know, or somebody tall, which I'm not definitely, looking down on someone who's probably about 2 feet tall. And so I was kind of thinking to myself, no, how would I use my power? Would I use it in a negative way, or would I use it in a positive way? I think as I've kind of processed through that, what I really should be doing is getting off the chair. But I was just kind of playing with that image. And you know, I think really it would be better to get off the chair and be at the same level and figure out how to do that. But again, also being in power, figuring out how to use that power in a very positive way.
Part of the whole struggle, coming back off of what Jody said also, has to do with the not just simply seeing ourselves as people of power, because it's incredible how most of us talk about ourselves as being powerless or small, or our culture not being the kind of thing we're trying to preserve and so forth, like, but rather to what degree we who have an identified participation in the masses have power enforced for us. And have the benefits come to us without having to physically see ourselves on a chair, and what that means in terms of rediscovering, and an additional thing, what is done with our memory in that process of in this culture without a memory, and which destroys and distorts and reinterprets history for the sake of our own self-righteousness. So a lot of that imagery is fun to deal with, both in terms of who's on a chair for us, as well as how we collectively get off the chair.
Mm-hmm. There'd be no question in my mind that I view myself, if I portrayed myself back, as an Egyptian. And being an Egyptian then, I'm sure I'd have the same mindset I have now, and that is to be justified in my existence in the operation of the current system, and to feel justified, correct, and legitimate in my actions. So the realization of the Exodus story as a liberation theology with reaction was shock, fear, and trepidation, and a substantial amount of anxiety having the tables turned. And that's a reaction. Mm-hmm. It might be an unenlightened Holden Village reaction, but that's a reaction. Mm.
I'm sure that's the most human and real of all of our reactions.
I'm not sure if I can really put this together to make sense of it, but one reaction that I have is that in everything we've said, which all of which makes sense, we've left out one element, and maybe this is because I come from the tradition that spiritualized everything. But it seems to me in this story, rather than looking at it totally as an economic and social thing, we've left out the idea that in this particular story, the Israelites were the people who knew God. The Egyptians were the ones who did not. And God was the one who was really creating the liberation. He was the one who picked Moses, who sent the 10 plagues, who opened the Red Sea, etc. And so I think if we look, take ourselves back, if we put ourselves, look at ourselves economically and socially, we have to put ourselves with Egyptians, it would be unreasonable and lying to say we were not. But if we take the spiritual element, being children of God, we have to see ourselves with the Israelites. And I wonder
if the story might not have been totally different if the Egyptian had also known God, and if, you know, what twist that would have put in the story. It could have come out totally different. So I think it's a little unrealistic for us to say, okay, I'm an Egyptian, or to say, okay, I'm an Israelite, because we have a foot in both doors, which makes it more difficult to see, I think, how we should proceed, how we are to bring liberation for all.
Let me leave that as the last remark. We have to stop in a few minutes, and I just want to make a concluding statement about what this might have to do with some of our thoughts in the rest of the week. It certainly is true, up to a point, what you said, but it is equally as true, maybe even more than up to a point in our country, that the dominant religion that passes itself off as the faith is a nationalistic religion that enforces the position of Pharaoh and takes a massive part of the population using all the language that's required for religiosity to confuse an identity. And you would see it even in greater magnification in South Africa, but just the same here, because the lines are drawn more sharply there. But the identification, whether or not you're playing with the Exodus story or not, if you want to really play with it even further, there was in fact a large monotheistic movement of religion in Egypt at the time. And so you can also play with the fact that that when the people left across the Red Sea, they were not just Israelites, the great band of Egyptians with them. So you can play with a lot of stuff, and I'm only using this as a way of our getting both into Scripture and into ourselves and into our own situations, into the question of what someone said at the very beginning, that there must have been, and in fact there were, friends, Egyptians who were friends of Moses are referred to three or four times in the story as who became semi-negotiators for Pharaoh, the in-between people. Which a lot of pastors, white pastors, have been in the civil rights movement. There were a tremendous amount of pro-liberation people. Being an Egyptian does not mean you have to be against freedom and liberation and justice. Being an Egyptian does not make you just simply automatically a person who does not want to be free yourself, let alone being and seeing in that which the Israelites are crying for and struggling for and fighting for and aiming towards is not the right thing to be and to follow. The South Africans talk about even two kinds of white people who are against apartheid. Those who want apartheid to end but not lose their privilege, and those who are really willing to live in a democratic process that is a rainbow culture in which the power to change and be changed is vested simply and continuously in the white people, just the disbanding of apartheid. I think that we just need to struggle with the question this week about what it means to be the white band in the rainbow and to see the entire rainbow that we are participating in as a rainbow of liberation and justice that we participate in bringing into being, that we contribute to, even in rediscovering what it means, our own culture, because they have also, you're right, for the Swedes and the Norwegians who have been given the Big Macs, who are we and what is our identity in the context of people who are coming into a greater pride of rediscovering identity culturally, but whose identification culturally contributes to an identity as part of the body of Christ. We're going to go right into the next session with the good bishop talking about what that struggle means for us to be building a rainbow church.